C1M. Number 3A.
Now, this morning we have done the first subject where we saw that the first subject postulates the quality of being obedient and respectful to law. Now here again we could ask ourselves, well, is this respect for law a moral effort, or from where can we get this strength? And so let's see how very naturally the first subject in prayer and the first subject in atonement and Eucharist leads to this quality of law abiding. You see, in prayer, the first subject was that our mind, our thought, our whole inward seeking was reaching out to know God as He is, was reaching out for the one mind. And in reaching out for the one mind, Atonement and Eucharist comes and says, by doing so, we have to sacrifice our own mind, our own will, and be willing to be bound but to this one mind. Be willing to be bound but to this one mind. Naturally, that establishes in me a sense of being obedient to the one mind. And so this first subject in marriage is a very natural outcome of prayer and atonement and Eucharist. Can you see that? That therefore our volition to be law-abiding and law-preserving and law-respecting isn't a morally learned effort, but it should really be always the outcome of the preceding chapters. Of the preceding chapters in prayer, where my mind goes out to know the one mind. And that demands in Eucharist that I give up my own sense of will and willpower, my own sense of the egoistic mind of knowing, of atoning oneself, and just to be bound to that one mind and be willing to be bound to that one mind. And that cultures in me and awakens in me a sense of being law-abiding, law-respecting. Can you see that? Therefore, we can see that it is a divine impulse and a divine source that is enabling us to fulfill the subject of marriage, and not the moral effort. In this first subject, to recapitulate its epitome, we have seen that a respect for law and for legal and moral laws and for divine laws, naturally, that any respect for law has an exalting, refining influence on humanity, on society. Now the second subject takes other qualities. The moment we come to the second subject, there is no more the question of this respect for law, but it appeals to quite different qualities, namely to the qualities, I would say, the qualities of the heart, of pure affection. There, she shows that only in pure affection can spiritual qualities naturally blend. They blend there naturally, they unite, we get again that unity of principle. And as they unite naturally, they have an effect on humanity. That effect which he depicts here is an enriching effect. It's the substance of life that is brought out, that it enriches the whole human nature. That it enriches man, you see, the whole human nature of man, humanhood. So, can you see again the combinations of these tones, what she says? The second subject by itself is a presentation that if we take spiritual qualities and if we blend them, they only will have an effect if we blend them in their purity. The great sense of purity goes through it, that only the heart which is tender, pure and loving, that only in such a heart pure qualities blend. She shows that the link of blending, that which sticks qualities together, so to say, is purity, purity of affection. And so this is the second subject. It's all about the purity of affection as the linking element for all spiritual qualities. It brings always out the scriptural note of principle life truth. It brings out that in the measure as this purity of affection is present, that then these qualities unite naturally, principle, and that they have an effect, namely they begin to enrich every quality, they begin to enrich it, enlarging it. You get the sense of life, of the multiplication of life, renewing it, and in enriching it, it enriches the human nature, gives a better, richer sense of manhood. She shows that right at the beginning, where she says that union of the masculine and feminine qualities constitutes completeness. It's the union, that which God has put together, let no man put asunder. God has put together masculine qualities and feminine qualities. There is a union. Let no man put that asunder. Let nothing in us put that asunder. The masculine mind reaches a higher tone through certain elements of the feminine. See, it says that if the masculine mind and the feminine mind conjoin, if they blend, it has the ability to bring about something new, namely it reaches a higher tone. It's not only an addition, but it's multiplication. It gives something new. It reaches a higher tone. Or on the other side, while the feminine mind gains courage and strength, the feminine mind certainly gains something the moment it is blended with the masculine quality. These different elements conjoin naturally with each other. You see, they conjoin naturally with each other. What God has put together, let no man put asunder. And their true harmony is in spiritual oneness. And now she gives that sense that both sexes should be loving, pure, tender, and strong. You see, all qualities of spirit. She shows here that the qualities of Spirit really is that which is able to link the qualities of the right qualities together and fructify these qualities and bring about a higher richness of nature, of the human nature. The attraction between native qualities will be perpetual only as it is pure and true, bringing sweet seasons of renewal like the returning spring. It's something which we may like to ponder during the next 2 months. Those laws which she always gives time and time again, showing that if true qualities are blended, be it individually or collectively, be it within one's own mentality, or be it within the range of a collective relationship, doesn't matter which way. It's true in both ways, because spiritual things are qualities are not limited to any place or person. So it shows that the blending of qualities have a fructifying effect. They bring about something more than what they bring into the storehouse. That we can bring together the masculine mind and the feminine mind, but if they are blended, they bring forth the third. They gain more courage and strength and a higher tone and whatever she says. It brings about something new and higher. That's the wonder of spiritual things. Then, having presented in this first paragraph of Spirit of Mind that spiritual qualities blend naturally in a pure mental attitude, that if our mental attitude is pure, that then the spiritual qualities can blend. Then comes the second paragraph, which says, therefore, be careful that your affections are not sidetracked, that they are not diverged towards a false affection, towards material affection. Beauty, wealth, or fame is incompetent to meet the demands of the affection and should never weigh against the better claims of intellect, goodness, and virtue. We get at once the separation process of weighing against one another the material affections of beauty, wealth, and fame, and on the other side, the spiritual affections of intellect, goodness, and virtue. Happiness is spiritual, born of truth and love. It is unselfish. Therefore, it cannot exist alone, but requires all mankind to share it. She shows again that only spiritual qualities are illimited. Can you say illimited or unlimited? Unlimited. And that spiritual qualities, therefore, cannot be kept back to oneself. They would become selfish, and therefore they would no more be pure. So here we see that in watching the spiritual qualities and the affection for spiritual qualities, that is not diluted or adulterated by affections for worldly qualities. And then lastly, she says in the third paragraph of Spirit as Soul, where she gives the struggle for pure affection and shows that it has always a resurrecting effect, says human affection is not poured forth vainly. See, it's never poured forth vainly. There's always multiplication. Even though it were even though it meet no return. Love, that's with a small L, you see that love. Love enriches the nature, enlarging, purifying, and elevating it. We see here again that love has, that love, which is that attraction of pure affection, that has in itself the faculty, the ability, the power, the creative ability to enrich the nature, do something which is big and vast and wide, to enrich the nature, to enlarge the nature, to purify and elevate the nature. So here we have one of these examples again, that using a spiritual quality is not just for the sake of having the spiritual qualities or having just the result of the spiritual quality, but it always brings a blossoming out. It always brings an enormous enrichment and unfoldment and a vastness, and it, you know so well how sometimes a little small gesture can awaken up in somebody else something very vital and big. That sometimes a word or a sign of confidence to somebody else can wake up in the other enormous energies of self-reliance and vigor which is willing to stand up again on the knees and to go forward again and so on. That sometimes only a gesture of kindness is quite enough to resuscitate the health of the one to whom we give this kindness. It shows that sometimes the least spiritual quality has in itself the seed to bring into blossom and to bring to birth, to bring out quite new and sometimes very big faculties and abilities and qualities. Sometimes it is the very thing that is needed for a new life, for a start in new life, for a regeneration of health and of energy and I don't know what. And if we see that, and if we realize the power and the energy that lies hidden in these qualities, then perhaps sometimes we would use them more. The wintry blasts of earth may uproot the flowers of affection and scatter them into the winds. But the severance of fleshly ties serves to unite thought more closely to God, for love supports the struggling heart until it ceases to sigh over the world. Even, she shows here, even that if humanly it meets no return, the return is always big, because it always turns us to God. It always turns us to a closer unity to God, and that naturally is the biggest reward we can ever have. So human affection is never poured forth vainly, even if they need no return, because the return is always there. It may be just that it draws us nearer and nearer to the one God. Sometimes nothing better can happen than to be felt left alone, to be deserted by people and by help. That helps us to cling to God more and more, and that's a blessing. So we see here again in this paragraph of Spirit to Soul how in our struggle for pure affection, you see, soul as spirit to spirit gave us that struggle to draw away our affection from beauty, wealth, and fame, and bind our affection to the spiritual qualities of intellect, goodness, and virtue. And in that struggle, we see that it always has a return, that this love in this struggle always enriches the human nature, or it brings us always nearer to the source of all blessedness, namely to God. It has always a resurrecting effect. So the second subject shows that fundamentally, you see, that fundamentally spiritual qualities are always one. What God has put together, let no man put asunder. And God has put together all spiritual qualities. Therefore she speaks of that fundamental unity. She speaks of the union of masculine and feminine qualities, that these different elements conjoin naturally with each other, that their true harmony is in spiritual oneness. And then we ask, what is it that hinders us to express this oneness which God has joined together? Then it is that we may not have pure affection. Pure affections is the key to participate in this spiritual oneness. So that which hinders us, that we are not constantly taking part in this union of spiritual qualities which have the ability to multiply and multiply and bring to birth new qualities, that which hinders us to do that, she says in the text, is that if we are not loving, pure, tender, and strong. This seems to be the main point. That the moment we are unselfish in our outlook, therefore pure in our outlook, we don't limit these qualities which are universal and which are here for all mankind to share it, and therefore every one of us can share them. Yeah. So, how did we arrive at this second subject? How can we have that purity of affection, which is the key to participate in this union of spiritual qualities with all its richness and vastness? Well, it's always through the second subject of prayer and atonement and Eucharist. In the prayer, we had that sense. It was the prayer of gratitude and of worshipping the good that we already have. We saw that attitude of worshipping the good, that is the basis that good can unfold. But Atonement and Eucharist came along and said in the second subject, yes, but this demands to turn away from that which is unlike God's good, so that we may be bound really more and more to the imperishable things of spirit. Well, naturally, in the measure as we obey this second subject in Atonement and Eucharist, in the measure that we obey and turn away more and more from the material sense of things and self and from the material as a center and circumference of being and turn more and more towards the spiritual worship and the imperishable things of spirit, something in us becomes more and more spiritual. We inherit more and more the spiritual. And so our affections naturally become purer and purer. Quite naturally, they become purer and purer, and more the spiritual qualities in us then can blend. So again, can we see how these subjects all link together, that the Word leads to the Christ as we have seen yesterday, but we also see today how the Christ always leads to Christianity, because the Christ is always that which comes to us and asks out that which is unlike God, and therefore makes room and for that which is like God. And so that which is like God has a bigger place in our heart, and as we see here in marriage, the more these spiritual qualities take place in our heart, the faster they develop, the wider is their newness of life which they bring with them. So through prayer, by praying and worshipping God good, and through Atonement and Eucharist, which asks me to turn away from the material sense of things and turn towards the spiritual things, something in me becomes more spiritual, more tender, more spiritually affectionate, and so that this second subject in marriage becomes natural in me, that my affections become purer, tender, more loving, more stronger, and in the measure as these awake in me, then the scriptural note comes into action, that it always brings a vaster and a richer field, and that it blesses me as man, that it blesses mankind. Now, we come to the third subject. The third subject is very different again in tone. Just as we felt that the first subject gives the qualities of respect for law, and the second subject something very different, namely the purity of our affection and the purification of our affection. The third is of a very different nature, namely it asks us to see the unselfishness of being. The third has a lot to do with selflessness. And selflessness naturally means that we look away from self, from the egoistic, the egotistic, and therefore that we see the one common interest of all. It's an altruistic outlook. It's looking away from the limited ego or self. What she shows here is that tone of soul as that showing that in selflessness there is unity of interest, or that only in selflessness we can have a unity of interest. And the effect of it is, the scriptural note, life and truth. Namely, he shows that if we have that unity of interest, then this has the effect that it brings a higher and wider range of happiness and joy to every partner which is engaged in this common interest. How does she show this selflessness? Or how does she show this breaking of any sense of narrowness and limitation and confinement and so on? In this subject, she speaks about the wide capacity of the outlook and horizon, that we must have a wide outlook, a wide horizon, that we must enlarge our horizon. You see how now that selflessness, that breaking of the narrowness comes in. It is as if she would say that our caliber must really be wide and far. And it's all against that sense of being small and narrow and confined and selfish and egotistic and self-centered and so on. She demands a wide altruistic outlook. She demands to view, so to say, the whole and not the part. And for instance, she says that we should have constant intercourse with those who can elevate existence. You see, it's against that sense of cliques, of narrowness. It says, let's share our thoughts with all those who can elevate thoughts. She asks for unselfish ambition, for ambitions. She asks to widen the horizon of a worthy outlook. She asks for more diffusive benevolence, for no confinement within four walls, and that home should not be the boundary of our affection. So, can you feel a very different tone that comes in? A tone of breaking the limitations, breaking the sense of narrowness and littleness and pettiness and confinement and all that. She asks for the unity of the common interest and therefore asks for moral freedom and for mutual freedom. There is a great sense of mutuality in this tone. Time and time again, she uses that sense, that term mutual, or the sense of mutuality, bringing out that we have all one common interest and that we cannot split the common interest into tiny little narrow interests. She speaks of mutual freedom, of mutual attention, mutual approbation, mutual compromise, mutual understanding, the old mutuality. Finding a sense that not the ego is important, but the fact itself. Therefore, she asks in this subject for the unity of interest, for the identity of interest, for the interchange of confidence and love. You see, it's an interchange, it's again mutual, for a tender solicitude for each other's happiness. See, it's not egoistic, for each other's happiness. Sympathies, she said, should blend in sweet confidence and fear. They should blend with each other, each partner sustaining the other, It's not a question of each one fighting for his own life. And thereby hallowing the union of interests and affections. Hallowing the union of interests and affections. So what we will encounter here in this third subject is really that sense of mutuality, of union of interests, of identity of all the interests, where all interests are identical in one common interest. And that naturally can never be achieved without the willingness to give up a selfish attitude, selfish, confined, little, egotistic attitude, where the first thought is always, what do I get out of it? Where do I come in this picture? All that is out of question.